Chapter 17. An object of the greatest pity, for I know of no greater than a gentleman of his habits without the means of gratifying them. He must live well, and he has not the means. Is there a more pathetic case? As for a mere low beggar, some laborless laborer, or some weaver out of place, don't let us throw away our compassion upon them. Sah! They're accustomed to starve. They can sleep upon boards, or dine off a crust, whereas a gentleman would die in the same situation. I think this was poor Morgiana's way of reasoning. For Walker's cash in prison beginning presently to run low, and knowing quite well that the dear fellow could not exist there without the luxuries to which he had been accustomed, she borrowed money from her mother until the poor old lady was a sec. She even confessed, with tears, to Woolsey that she was in particular want of £20 to pay a poor milliner whose debt she could not bear to put in her husband's schedule. And I need not say she carried the money to her husband, who might have been greatly benefited by it, only he had a bad run of luck at the cards, and how the deuce can a man help that? Woolsey had repurchased for her one of the cashmere shawls. She left it behind her one day at the Fleet Prison, and some rascal stole it there, having the grace, however, to send Woolsey the ticket, signifying the place where it had been pawned. Who could the scoundrel have been? Woolsey swore a great oath, and fancied he knew, but if it was Walker himself, as Woolsey fancied, and probably as was the case, who made away with the shawl, being pressed thereto by necessity, was it fair to call him a scoundrel for so doing, and should we not rather laud the delicacy of his proceeding? He was poor. Who can command the cards? But he did not wish his wife should know how poor. He could not bear that she should suppose him arrived at the necessity of pawning a shawl. She who had such beautiful ringlets, of a sudden pleaded cold in the head, and took to wearing caps. One summer evening, as she and the baby and Mrs. Crump and Woolsey, let us say all four babies together, were laughing and playing in Mrs. Crump's drawing room, playing the most absurd gambols, fat Mrs. Crump, for instance, hiding behind the sofa, Woolsey chuck-chucking, cock-a-doodle-doing, and performing those indescribable freaks which gentlemen with philoprogenitive organs will execute in the company of children. In the midst of their play, the baby gave a tug at his mother's cap. Off it came, her hair was cut close to her head. Morgiana turned as red as sealing wax, and trembled very much. Mrs. Crump screamed, "My child, where is your hair?" And Woolsey, bursting out with a most tremendous oath against Walker that would send Miss Prim into convulsions, put his handkerchief to his face, and actually wept. "He infernal bubble bubble blackguard," said he, roaring and clenching his fists. As he had passed the Bower of Bloom a few days before, he saw Mazarus, who was combing out a jet-black ringlet, and held it up, as if for Woolsey's examination, with a peculiar grin. The tailor did not understand the joke, but he saw now what had happened. Morgiana had sold her hair for 5 guineas. She would have sold her arm had her husband bidden her. On looking in her drawers, it was found as he had sold almost all her wearing apparel. The child's clothes were all there, however. It was because her husband talked of disposing of a gilt coral that the child had, that as he had parted with the locks which had formed her pride. "I'll give you 20 guineas for that hair, you infamous fat coward," roared the little tailor to Eglanton that evening. "Ive it up, or I'll kill you, Mr. Mazarus." "Mr. Mazarus!" shouted the perfumer. "Vell, vatch the matter, vatch the row, fight away, my boys. 2-1 on the tailor," said Mr. Mazarus, much enjoying the sport, for Woolsey, striding through the shop without speaking to him, had rushed into the studio, where he plumped upon Eglanton.
"Tell him about that hair, sir. That hair. Now keep yourself quiet, Mr. Timble, and don't think for to bully me. You mean Mrs. Walker's hair? Why, she sold it me. And the more blackguard you for buying it. Will you take 20 guineas for it?"
"No," said Mazarus.
25?
"Can't," said Mazarus.
"Hang it. Will you take 40?
There.
I wish I'd kept it, said the Hebrew gentleman, with unfeigned regret. Glanton dressed it this very night. For Countess Baldenstern, the Swedish ambassador's lady, says Glanton, his Hebrew partner, was by no means a favorite with the ladies, and only superintended the accounts of the concern. Tease this very night at Devonshire House, with four ostrich plumes, lappets, and trimmings. And now, Mr. Woolsey, I'll trouble you to apologize. Mr. Woolsey did not answer, but walked up to Mr. Glanton, and snapped his fingers so close under the perfumer's nose, that the latter started back, and seized the bell rope. Mazarus burst out laughing, and the tailor walked majestically from the shop, with both hands stuck between the lappets of his coat. My dear, said he to Morgina a short time afterwards, you must not encourage that husband of yours in his extravagance, and sell the clothes off your poor back, that he may feast, and act the fine gentleman in prison. It is his health, poor dear soul, interposed Mrs. Walker Cole in his chest. Every farthing of the money goes to the doctors, poor fellow. Well, now listen. I am a rich man. It was a great fib, for Woolsey's income, as a junior partner of the firm, was but a small one. I can very well afford to make him an allowance, while he is in the fleet, and have written to him to say so. But if you ever give him a penny, or sell a trinket belonging to you, upon my word and honor I will withdraw the allowance, and, though it would go to my heart, I'll never see you again. You wouldn't make me unhappy, would you? I'd go on my knees to serve you, and heaven bless you, said the wife. Well, then, you must give me this promise. And she did. And he now, said he, your mother, and Podmore, and I have been talking over matters, and we've agreed, that you may make a very good income for yourself. Though, to be sure, I wish it could have been managed any other way, but needs must, you know. You're the finest singer in the universe. La, said Morgina, highly delighted. I never heard anything like you, though I'm no judge. Podmore says he is sure you will do very well, and has no doubt you might get very good engagements at concerts, or on the stage, and as that husband will never do any good, and you have a child to support, sing you must. Oh, how glad I should be, to pay his debts and repay all he has done for me, cried Mrs. Walker. Think of his giving 200 guineas to Mr. Bereskite to have me taught. Was not that kind of him? Do you really think I should succeed? There's Miss Larkins has succeeded. The little high-shouldered vulgar thing, says Morgina. I'm sure I ought to succeed if she did. She sing against Morgina? Said Mrs. Crump. Do you like to see her, indeed? She ain't fit to snuff a candle to her. I dare say not, said the tailor, though I don't understand the thing myself. But if Morgina can make a fortune, why shouldn't she? Heaven knows we want it, we'll see, cried Mrs. Crump. Indeed, to see her on the stage was always the wish of my heart. And so it had formerly been the wish of Morgina. And now, with the hope of helping her husband and child, the wish became a duty, and she fell to practicing once more from morning till night. One of the most generous of men and tailors who ever lived now promised, if further instruction should be considered necessary, though that he could hardly believe possible, that he would lend Morgina any sum required for the payment of lessons, and accordingly she once more betook herself, under Podmore's advice, to the singing school. Borowski's academy was, after the passages between them, out of the question, and she placed herself under the instruction of the excellent English composer Sir George Thrum, whose large and awful wife, Lady Thrum, dragon of virtue and propriety, kept watch over the master and the pupils, and was the sternest guardian of female virtue on or off any stage. Morgina came at a propitious moment. Bereskite had launched Miss Larkins under the name of Ligonier. The Ligonier was enjoying considerable success, and was singing classical music to tolerable audiences, whereas Miss Butts, Sir George's last pupil, had turned out a complete failure, and the rival house was only able to make a faint opposition to the new star with Miss Werder, who, though an old favorite, had lost her upper notes and her front teeth, and, the fact was, drew no longer. Directly Sir George heard Mrs. Walker, he tapped Podmore, who accompanied her, on the waistcoat, and said, "Poddy, thank you. We'll cut the Orange Boy's throat with that voice." It was by the familiar title of Orange Boy that the great Bereskai was known among his opponents. "We'll crush him, Podmore," said Lady Thrum, in her deep hollow voice. "Who may stop and dine?" And Podmore stayed to dinner, and ate cold mutton, and drank Marsala with the greatest reverence for the great English composer. The very next day Lady Thrum hired a pair of horses, and paid a visit to Mrs. Crump, and her daughter at Sadler's Wells. All these things were kept profoundly secret from Walker, who received very magnanimously the allowance of 2 guineas a week which Wolsey made him, and with the aid of the few shillings his wife could bring him, managed to exist as best he might. He did not dislike gin, when he could get no claret, and the former liquor, under the name of ape, used to be measured out pretty liberally in what was formerly Her Majesty's Prison of the Fleet. Morgina pursued her studies under Thrum, and we shall hear in the next chapter how it was she changed her name to Ravenswing. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.